Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Riding Shotgun by William W. Johnstone and J.A. Johnstone. Narrated by J. Rodney Turner. Chapter 1.
Ryan! Red Ryan! I'm calling you out. Damn your rise, fill your head and get down here.
Red, do you hear that?
Yeah, I hear that. Ignore him, Dolly, and he'll go away, Ryan said. Now where were we? The naked woman in the bed smiled.
I was asking if you love me, Red.
Love you? I sure do, and that's a natural fact.
Do you tell the other girls that you love them?
Nah, Dolly, I just tell it to you.
Patsy Prentice says that every time you're in town, you talk all kinds of pretties to her. You never talk pretties to me.
Yeah, I do. All the time. Hell, Dolly, you're as pretty as a speckled pup under a wagon. When I first rode into Cassidy Crossing and saw you standing on the balcony with the other ladies that time, I thought, well, Red, she's the only gal for you and no mistake.
That time? Red, it was only yesterday.
Time flies when you're having fun, don't it? Now come closer and give me some more of that good old Texas lovin'.
Ryan, are you coming down or do I have to come up there after you?
The man's voice from the street, strident and angry.
I aim to shoot you down like a dog, Ryan, and be damned to you.
Go away, Red called. At the moment, I'm real busy.
Come down here, Ryan.
Later.
Now!
Give me 10 minutes, you damn nuisance, whoever you are. You should be hung for disturbing a man.
Get down here now, damn you.
The bullet that crashed through the bedroom window added the exclamation point to the end of that sentence.
That's it. I'm out of here, Dolly said. Everybody told me you were a crazy man, Red Ryan, and you are.
The girl rolled off the bed and gathered up her frillies and then stood at the door, staring expectantly at Red. Even when she frowned as she was doing now, he had to admit that she was a real pretty little gal. In my wallet, he said. Dolly grabbed the wallet from the dresser and took out some bills.
There's only $3 here.
And you're most welcome to it, little darling, Ryan said.
That's all? Dolly said. That's all the money you have?
It's all I got. And when $3 is all a man has, he's given you his entire fortune.
You damn cheapskate, Red Ryan, Dolly said. Who's going to pay for the window?
I'll talk to Dark Alley Jim, tell him I'll pay him for the window next time I'm in town. Ryan ducked as a bullet shattered another pane. Uh-oh. Make that 2 windows. Now there was a deal of shouting and screaming in the upstairs rooms of the Golden Garter Saloon and Sporting House, and the proprietor, Dark Alley Jim Mortimer, loudly demanded to know who was trying to murder his whores. Dolly Barnes opened the bedroom door and yelled,
Jim, it's Red Ryan. He's been called out.
Ryan, you damn troublemaker, get away from here and deal with this before my place is all shot to pieces, Mortimer hollered. Then the man himself burst through the door, saw Ryan struggling into his long johns, and said, motioning with a greener 10-gauge for emphasis, get out there on the street and don't come back here ever again. I thought you were my good friend, Jim, Ryan said. I've shot good friends afore, Mortimer said. And you're not my friend, good or any other kind. Ryan pulled on his boots, slammed a derby hat on his unruly mane of red hair, and slid his Colt from the holster, leaving his own greener shotgun in a corner. Scatterguns always meant a killing, and he was hopeful that this situation could be resolved by prudent words rather than buckshot. Red stepped to the window, flung it open, and yelled, I'm coming down.
He caught a brief glance of an angry but respectable-looking gent in the street who held a revolver in each hand. Dressed only in hat, boots, and fire-engine-red underwear, Ryan brushed past Mortimer and thumped down the stairs and onto the porch that ran the length of the building. The respectable-looking gent was obviously not in the mood for words, prudent or otherwise, and he didn't waste any time in palaver. He cut loose with both six guns, and Ryan ducked as bullets crashed into the door and the woodwork around it. In one round, better aimed than the others, drilled a neat hole through the crown of his derby. "Well, the hell with this," Red said. He thumbed off a shot, and the respectable-looking man clutched his right shoulder, dropped his guns, and howled, "Damn, he shot me!" Ryan stepped off the porch into the street, his Colt hanging by his side, and said, "What the hell did you expect me to do? Mister, with all that shooting you did, you could have plugged Dolly Barnes, the best value for money whore this side of the Concho River." "I was trying to kill you, not a lady," the respectable-looking man said. His face was ashen, and he was in obvious pain, grimacing under his mustache. "Why, I never seen you before in my life," Red said. "You're Red Ryan, ain't you?" the man said. The crowd had gathered and looked on Ryan with hostile eyes, seeing a known rowdy who'd just drilled a respectable-looking gent in a frock coat and morning top hat. "Yep, that's my name," Ryan said. "You ride shotgun for the Patterson and Son stage?" "I have that honor, at least some of the time." "And you're the one that killed my young brother?" Amid cries of shame and disgraceful and string him up, from one half-drunk Banny Rooster who just stumbled out of the saloon and had no idea what the hell was going on. Ryan said, "When was this, and who was your brother?" And then, voicing his growing irritation, "As of right now, I'm starting to regret not putting another bullet into you, mister." "There speaks a born killer," a man wearing a storekeeper apron said. "String him up," the Banny Rooster said. "Here comes the doctor," a woman said. Dr. Miles Davis, short and stocky with gray hair and a melancholy face, helped the wounded man out of his coat and then stared hard at the blood-stained shoulder. "My brother's name was Lou Richards, and you gunned him 5 miles east of El Paso not 3 weeks ago," the respectable man said. He winced as the doctor worked his arm up and down, testing his shoulder. "I remember that. Your brother Lou Richards was a road agent," Ryan said. "He tried to hold up my stage, him and Banjo Bob Kidd. I knew Kidd from a couple years back when he was a yonker. He was still carrying the buckshot in his ass he got from my greener when he tried to rob a butterfield I was guarding. He was lucky that day. I wasn't aiming for his ass." "It's only a scratch," Dr. Davis said. "Mr. Richards. Hugh Richards." "Well, Mr. Richards, you're burned up some, but no bones broken." He looked at Ryan, not liking what he saw, and then back to the wounded man. "Here, take your coat. Come to my office later and I'll give you a salve for the bullet burn, if you're still above ground." "Listen to me, Richards, you damned fool. Yeah, I killed Banjo Bob on that El Paso run 3 weeks ago," Ryan said. "But I didn't kill Lou."
"For shame," a woman in the crowd said.
"Then who did?" Archie Richards said, grimacing as his wound pained him. "Dallas Stoudemire did, that's who," Red said. "Only a half-wit like Lou would try to steal a gold watch from an almighty dangerous gunfighter like Dallas."
"How did it happen?"
Richards said. If he was skeptical, he didn't let it show. "How did it happen? I'll tell you how it happened," Ryan said. "As it came down, Stoudemire was one of my passengers, and after the holdup, Lou said to him, 'Give me your wallet, watch, and chain.' Dallas said, 'Try and take them, and damn you for a common thief.' Then Lou said,
your funeral, Marianne, and he brought up his Colt. But quick as grease lightning, Dallas drew two revolvers and put four bullets into Lou. Now, Lou was hit hard, but he managed to put one round into our near-side Wheeler horse. Buttons Muldoon, my driver, was sure cut up about losing that $200 hoss. And he would have shot Lou all over again if he hadn't already been dead. "You swear all that on the Bible?" Richard said. "I don't have a Bible, but I give you my word for it," Red said. "Then considering how it happened, it seems like I owe you an apology, mister," Richard said. He seemed crestfallen and out of sorts from the pain in his shoulder and from shooting at the wrong man. "You owe me more than an apology," Red Ryan said. "Call it $5 for the 3 panes of glass you broke, and 3 for the services of Dolly Barnes that I paid for but didn't get. That's $8. And I'll forget about the 10 cents for the bullet you forced me to shoot at you." Richard's face stiffened. "You're a hard man, Red Ryan." "No, partner, not hard, just broke. And I don't much feeling like telling Dark Alley Jim Mortimer that I can't pay for his broken windows. He has a quick temper and a quick draw to go with it." Richards reached into his coat pocket and produced his wallet. "There's a 10, Ryan. We'll call it quits." "Much obliged," Red said. "Now go see Doc Davis and get that shoulder fixed. And pick up your pistol and don't ever think of throwing down on a man again. Gunfighting sure ain't one of your hidden talents." "There's no change back, Red," Dark Alley Jim Mortimer said. "You scared the hell out of my horse and ruined this morning's business. Besides that, one of them bullets went through your wall into the next room and burned across Deacon Elijah Dogmersfield's bare ass. Now he says it's a sign from God that he should quit consorting with fallen women and tread the path of righteousness alongside his 300-pound wife." "Sorry to hear that," Ryan said. "Seems that everybody's getting burned with bullets this morning." "You're sorry? Think how sorry I'll be if Deacon Dogmersfield spreads the word that a sporting man can get shot at the Golden Garter, and I lose the gospel grinder trade. This is a serious concern to me, Red." "Sorry about that too, Jim," Red said, trying his best to look penitent. Mortimer sighed and said, "All right, here's the way I see it, Red. Loss of the services of 4 scared whores, $25. Loss of revenue obtained from champagne sales to the clients of those 4 whores, $25. Add that up and it comes to $50. And I'll pay you the very next time I'm in town," Ryan said, blinking. "Figured you'd say that, Red." Jim Mortimer's smile was not pleasant. "That's why I'm holding your shotgun, cartridge belt, and holster, your fancy buckskin shirt, and your pants hostage until the debt is paid in full." Red Ryan was shocked. "Now just hold on there, Jim. You can't do that." "Yes, I can. I can't face the world in my underwear." "Get used to it," Mortimer said. Sick at heart, Red Ryan sat on the porch step outside the Golden Garter, his head in his hands, wondering how a morning that had begun so full of promise, so full of the fair Dolly Barnes, could have turned to such complete horse dung. A shadow fell over Ryan, dark as his mood, and he looked up and saw the large form of his driver, Patrick Buttons Muldoon. "Taking in some sun, Red," Button said. Ryan shook his head. "Ran into some trouble this morning." "What was it this time? Fist or gun?" "Gun. Feller by the name of Richards called me out. The brother of the road agent Dallas Stoudemire gunned that time on the El Paso run." "Hell, Red, why blame you? You didn't do it. The only feller you shot all day long was Banjo Bob Kidd. Seen that my own self." "Well, we got it sorted out in the end," Ryan said. "And you plugged the Richards feller?" "Scratched his shoulder. He's over at Doc Davis's place getting a plaster." "Where are your duns?" "Jim Mortimer's holding them hostage," Says I owe him $50 because Richard shot up the place, scared his horse, and shot Deacon Dogmersfield up the ass. And you don't have $50. What you see is what I got. You're a sorry sight, Red, and no mistake. I'll talk to Dark Alley Jim, Button said. The stage driver stood only 5'6", but he was as wide as he was tall, and a lifetime of wrestling half-broke horse teams had given him tremendously strong arms, and he had a volcanic temper that showed itself now and then. And now was one of those times. Muldoon stomped into the Golden Garter, and a few moments later, Red Ryan heard bottles smash and furniture splinter. And a few moments after that, Dark Alley Jim crashed through the front window of the saloon, landed in a heap, groaned, and lay still. Red stood, in time to see an almost naked Dolly Barnes sail through the now-destroyed window, but her landing was softer because she fell on top of her unconscious boss. Muldoon, dressed in a blue sailor coat decorated with two rows of silver buttons that gave him his name, reappeared. Ryan's greener under his arm, gun leather and duds thrown over his shoulder. Jim says you don't owe him a damn thing, and I got you $3 back from the whore he said you was with this morning, since services were not rendered, he said. Now get dressed and saddle your horse. Did you remember we got a stage to pick up in Fort Concho? Red Ryan and Buttons Muldoon rode out of town, dodging rocks thrown by four highly irritated whores led by Dolly Barnes, who yelled at Red that he was dirty, no good, low down. Ryan agreed with what the women called him, but the dirty part hurt. He and Buttons reached Fort Concho 3 days later. Chapter 2. Throughout its 22-year history, construction never ended at Fort Concho. And the day Red Ryan and Buttons Muldoon rode in under a black, growling sky, the post consisted of 40 buildings on 40 acres, surrounded by a vast wilderness of flat, treeless prairie. The Buffalo soldiers of the 10th Cavalry occupied the fort, commanded by Colonel Benjamin H. Grierson, a stern man who'd never recovered from his grief over the death of his 12-year-old daughter, who died in an upstairs bedroom of one of the houses at the post. Red and Buttons rode past the sutler's store, the bakery, and the blacksmith shop to the sandstone headquarters building. A Patterson and Son stage was parked a distance away, brought there by a relief driver a few days before. Muldoon stopped to inspect the coach, and Ryan swung from the saddle and looped his horse to the hitch rail. He looked around at the scouts coming and going across the parade ground, recognizing Big Tam McLeod, who'd scouted for Grierson during the colonel's successful 1880 campaign against Victorio that had ended the Apache threat to West Texas. "Tam!" Red yelled, waving. The big man stopped, turned, and looked at Ryan and shook his head. "Hell, I heard you was dead," he hollered, "and buried." "Not yet," Ryan called back. "I'm still above ground." "I see you got a bullet hole in that fancy hat of yourn," McLeod said. "Long story," Red said. The scout, looking more Indian than white man in greasy buckskins and feathered hat, walked up to Red and said, "All right. I got two versions of the happy story of your demise. One is that a jealous husband caught you in bed with his wife and shot you through and through with a pepper-box pistol. The second was that you was hung for a hoss thief in El Paso a year ago by Dallas Stoudemire. Now, which one of them is true?" "Neither, Tam, since I'm still alive and kicking." "Well, that's surely a sore disappointment, ain't it?" Ryan watched an 8-man patrol commanded by a boy second lieutenant ride out, their accoutrements jingling, a Pima wearing the blue headband of an Army scout ahead of them. "What's going on, Tam?" Red said. He and the scout went back a ways, and his smile showed that he held no ill will in regard to the big man's chagrin that he was still breathing. "The Apaches are out. The colonel is bringing in the settlers. Them that will come, anyway. I thought Victorio's death had ended all that Warpath stuff. But you're not alone. So did a lot of people. For the past 2 months, there's been a heap of coming and going around the Mescalero wiki-ups, and then a couple of weeks ago, about 20 young Chiricahua loiterers left the San Carlos and were welcomed by the Mescalero with open arms. How many hostiles are we talking about, Tam? Counting both Mescalero and Chiricahua, about 50, all of them young bucks, and they're already playing hob. So far, they've murdered 27 Americans, settlers, miners, army supply train escorts, and the like. And that number is likely to grow before the army catches up with them. Who's leading the Broncos? Old Nana? Or is Loco still alive? Yeah, Loco's still alive, but him and Nana are in Mexico where the pickings are easy. And they ain't likely to raid north of the Rio Grande again. This present bunch is led by a young war chief who calls himself Eilish. In Apache, that means Lord of the Earth. From what the Pima scouts tell me, Victorio's spirit came to Eilish in a great dream and promised him that if he led the United Apache tribes in battle, they'd drive out the white man and become lords of the earth. McLeod shook his head and then spat a stream of tobacco juice onto the sand. It's a bad business, Red. Ryan watched Buttons Muldoon closely inspect a bright yellow stage wheel and then said, I reckon the Patterson stage isn't going anywhere until this is over. Kind of depends on the attitude of the passengers, don't it? McLeod said. I have two patrols out, and in addition, the B Company under Captain Taylor scouting the old Butterfield stage route as far as Ketchum Mountain. Colonel Benjamin H. Grierson, tired and looking older than his years, said, It's a show of force, but a token one. The company is under strength, and if the hostiles are in the area, I doubt they'll be impressed. Thank God settlers are few and far between in this part of the country. A good reason for the Apaches to avoid Fort Concho. We just aren't important enough. Red Ryan didn't like what he heard. Colonel, I've been hired to guard the Patterson stage to Fort Bliss, he said. I know, Mr. Ryan. The passengers have already made that clear. Grierson glanced out his office window and said, Ah, I see Buttons Muldoon heading this way, and he looks none too happy. Somebody must have told him about the Apaches, Red said. A rare smile from Grierson, and then, That would be my guess. And the colonel was right. Muldoon's round, whiskered face was wrinkled in concern. He took off his leather glove and extended his hand. Good to see you again, Colonel. It's been a spell. Since the Victorio campaign, Buttons. Grierson said, You're looking well. Wish I could say the same about how I feel, Muldoon said. I've just been told that the Mescaleros are out, and about 20 Chiricahua bucks with them. They left the San Carlos 2 weeks ago, Grierson said. Me and Red have been hired to take the Patterson stage to Fort Bliss. Muldoon said. Yes, Mr. Ryan has already informed me of that fact, the colonel said. I can guarantee your safety as far as Ketchum Mountain, and perhaps a distance beyond, at Captain Taylor's discretion. I'll give you a note giving him my permission to use his best judgment. Colonel, it's 400 miles of rough country between here and Fort Bliss, Red Ryan said. That's 4 or 5 days on the trail and maybe longer. I doubt the passengers will want to make the trip. On the contrary, Mr. Ryan, they seem eager to leave. At least two of them do. I advise them to wait until the hostiles are corralled, but they insist on making the journey, Indian uprising or not. Ryan shook his head. Colonel, who are those people? Are they rubes from back east that don't know any better? Two of them are the wives of enlisted men, and they're traveling to Fort Bliss to join their husbands, Grierson said. My God, a couple of washerwomen, Muldoon said. No doubt, Buttons, no doubt, the colonel said. Are those women the two that want to make the trip? Ryan said. No. The stalwarts are Mrs. Stella Morgan, the wife of soon-to-retire Major John Morgan, currently stationed at Fort Bliss, and Mr. Lucien Carter, a San Antonio bank clerk heading farther west in hope of finding a better career situation. To the best of my knowledge, the two are traveling companions but are not related in any way.
I'll talk to them, Ryan said. Tell them.
But a commotion outside the door to the colonel's office stopped Red in mid-sentence. The door burst open and a tall young man barged inside, followed by a harried-looking desk sergeant.
"Sorry, sir," the soldier said. "I couldn't stop him."
"It's all right, sergeant," Grierson said. Then, "What can I do for you, Mr. Carter?" Carter was blonde, blue-eyed, and handsome, but he had a sulky, petulant mouth, almost effeminate in its fullness, and a pale skin that would flush easily and burn in the sun. There were bulges under the armpits of his expensive gray sack coat, and Ryan pegged him as a two-gun man, rare in the West and probably unique among bank clerks.
"I'll tell you what you can do for me, Grierson," Carter said, his face bright scarlet. "You can guarantee Mrs. Morgan and me a cavalry escort between here and Fort Bliss."
"On the frontier there are no guarantees, Mr. Carter," the colonel said. "My command is already spread thin, and I cannot spare men for escort duty. I suggest you remain here at the fort until the Apaches are rounded up and return to the reservation."
"No, that won't do," Carter said. "Mrs. Morgan is an army officer's wife, and she's anxious to be reunited with her husband because she has some tragic news to impart. She will brook no delay, and neither will I. As a gentleman, it is incumbent on me to see her safely to her destination."
"There are two other army wives involved, and they are willing to remain at the fort until the Apache threat is over," Grierson said. Carter's peevish mouth twisted into a contemptuous grin. "A couple of fat women married, or so they claim, to corporals," Carter said. "Who cares about such people?"
"I do," Red Ryan said. "If the two ladies in question are passengers of the Patterson and Son Stage and Express Company, and they paid the same fare to Fort Bliss as you did, until they reach the fort, they are my responsibility."
"And who the hell are you?" said Carter, a truculent, arrogant man Ryan had disliked on sight.
"Named Ryan. I ride shotgun for Abe Patterson."
Again, Carter's insolent grin. "Then, yeah, then that makes me feel a whole lot safer."
"You should," Buttons Muldoon said. "Red's the best scattergun guard there is, and I've ridden with a few."
Carter turned to Grierson. "You still insist that I can't have an escort?"
"I'm afraid it's out of the question," the colonel said. "Then you will take us there, Ryan?" Carter said. "We've paid our fares."
"Listen to the colonel, Carter," Ryan said. "Wait until the Apaches are penned."
"I'll pay you double what Patterson is paying," Carter said.
"No deal," Ryan said.
"Triple."
"I'll be on my way, colonel," Ryan said. He stepped past Carter, but the man shot out his arm and with considerable strength grabbed Ryan's right bicep and squeezed.
Hard.
"Don't you ever walk away from me when I'm talking to you," Carter said. There were a couple of warning signals Carter should have noticed about Red Ryan, but didn't. Most obvious was the fact that Red stood 6 feet and a half inch tall, and under his buckskin shirt, his shoulders and arms bulged with a pugilist's muscle, a holdover from his days as a bare-knuckle booth fighter with Dr. Edwin Drake's Medicine and Curiosity Show. Red had taken on all comers in the ring, had never once failed to come up to scratch, and his quick fists earned him a record of 63 wins with only one defeat, and that at the hands of an up-and-coming youngster by the name of Joseph Choinsky, the California Terror, who would later in his career fight the likes of James J. Jeffries, James Corbett, and Jack Johnson. The second fact Carter should already have known, that it's never a good idea to muscle a quick-tempered red-headed man with an arm as hard and big around as an iron stovepipe.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?